When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
No way, Jose.
The following footage proves beyond any doubt that the tanks intentionally set the house on fire. It proves that the Branch Davidians were murdered. You can see that this tank has a gas jet on the front that shoots fire. You can also see the fire quite plainly. The tank goes into the house twice, and each time as it backs out, the fire at the gas jet is plainly visible.
We must all do more to recognize and look for the early warning signals that deeply troubled young people send.
Hey guys, it's Jose Galison. You're watching No Way Jose. You can find me on the No Way Jose YouTube channel, all the major audio podcatchers, and Rumble as well. Today my guest is a return guest many times. I actually have a weekly show with him, if you guys watch that. Every week at Tuesday at 9:30, Already Dead. That my guest today is Austin Picard. We're finally starting our Watergate series. It's been a long time in the making. We had a couple of scheduling issues where one of us have something important come up in life, the other one the next time. So it happens. You have these scheduling issues. So we're finally getting around to it. Who knows? Maybe something will happen in the middle of this stream and screw it all up. But here we are. Third time's a charm. But yeah, I do want to remind people how this works. If you're a patron, you get this content early, roughly about a week or so. And if you want to get that, that's patreon.com/NoWayJose2020. The lowest level is $2 to be able to get those early access, or if you just want to support or whatever. And the highest level is my sponsors. I read them off every episode. My first sponsor is my co-host on Tower Gang, at Tower Gang Toad, and I also have at Abrogate D's and Kevin B. Clark, a full-time guitarist and private music teacher in the New York area. Then at ZoveracK, then at _InfiniteZeal, then Jacob Daniel of the Biblical Anarchy podcast, at Biblical Anarchy, then Tim Tuttle, at Jolly on Klebold. And then also I have my buddy Will Bell. I think he's Will Bell or not Will Bell or something on Twitter, but he's got Rabbit Eye Wine. This stuff's dope. I drank all this in like record time, way too quick. A little ashamed of that, but it's delicious stuff. Highly recommend it. But yeah, I just a big shout out to you guys. Help me do what I do. Don't make a ton of money doing this, but you guys keep me keeping on. But with that, let's go ahead, get Austin in here and get to it. What's up, my man? How you doing?
What's up, buddy?
What it do?
Watergate.
Yeah, dude.
Finally.
Yeah. It's funny. We just had Nick Bryan on the show the other day, and he just had the Watergate. I don't know when that book came out, but I know it's his most recent one. He had a Watergate book. And apparently, yeah, too long ago. You guys have similar conclusions, although you haven't read it yet. So I thought I was in the impression you were. I told Nick you had, so he has a higher.
How dare you, man? No, that's the only one I haven't, honestly. Yeah. But I will, and I'm hoping to by the end of the series. That way I can hopefully kind of, you know, compare notes in a way. But yeah. But I'm sure that he probably covered a lot of details that maybe haven't been covered in the past as much. And what I did hear him say is that he was kind of taking the approach of, he mentioned all these tomes basically that have been written about Watergate, which, man, there's over 100 books written about Watergate, right? But I think he was specifically referencing like four crucial works that I value most definitely, which is One Secret Agenda by Jim Hogan, Silent Coup by Lynn Kolodny, White House Call Girl by Phil Stanford, and Postgate by John O'Connor, who actually was like the legal representative for Mark Felt in like the 80s, I believe, who a lot of people consider to be Deep Throat, the anonymous, you know, source for Bernstein and Woodward at the time. But yeah, I don't really think that's the case after looking into it a little further. Anyway, so yeah, I kind of think the best way to start is first to kind of briefly lay out the political landscape of the time.
I would like to quickly just, even if it's just my dumbass doing it, just a quick overview of what the fuck Watergate even, like even just the most simplest, because I think, I would presume my audience is probably roughly in the same age range, plus or minus maybe 5-10 years as us. And this is definitely for our generation. I think me and you are within like a couple years in age of each other. I forget who's.
You're 32, right?
Yeah, I'll be 33 next month. So I think we're
about the same. Okay, yeah, I'm 32 as well.
Yeah, so we're about the same. So, like, yeah, I would assume your recollection of like actual real world knowledge as opposed to just.
I didn't
like
know shit about this before I came into it. Yeah.
You're just like Watergate. Mm-hmm. You thought it was some sort of spying on political. It's like kind of that vague concept. Mm-hmm. You don't even know the specifics at all.
Right.
You know, like you're just kind of like something about the president spying on his opposition and got busted doing it. And that's kind of, I think, the vague recollection that most people have. I don't know if there's anything you want to add to that more, that kind of like, I guess, what roughly vaguely the official narrative has become. Because I feel like as it is always with these sorts of events, there are like layers. Even in what the official narrative is. Like, what I just labeled really probably isn't even fair to call it the official narrative. That's the, like, public consciousness's official narrative. And then you have, like, maybe you could have, like, the cursory understanding official narrative. You know what I mean? Like, and, like, this happens a lot with, like, JFK. Like, you know, like, people will be like, at one level, they'll be like, oh, this was clearly a lone gunman. And then it's like, oh, well, you had help. Maybe it was the Russians. And then there's like layers. And the next thing you know, you're thinking about the black nobility or something.
Yeah. Oh, God.
I don't know. But you get the point. There are layers. And sometimes maybe people are looking for layers that aren't there. But that is just true, that there is like this public consciousness one. So I think I just laid out what the public consciousness narrative. What would you even just say? I just kind of would be like the maybe the. What would be, and maybe you aren't even, maybe you would admit that you may not have a grip on what the proper answer for this, but what would be like the cursory understanding official narrative? Like someone who actually at that time point in time in history probably even took the tiniest bit of time to understand it, but without taking an overly critical view of it, like maybe me or you would, and be like, huh, this doesn't add up. Like what was kind of the sum parts of the story, what you think? Just kind of like vaguely what the... anyone who like read the newspaper is what they would, the impression they would get from it.
Definitely. Well, I think what really took the day as far as the official narrative is concerned and what the public really embraced for the plausible outcome as far as, you know, why they would get behind, you know, so quickly get behind, you know, what basically became a coup and, you know, the overthrow and at least, I mean, the fallout of after the burglary, which led to the removal of a president. But I mean, the official version is really what Woodward and Bernstein, you know, put forward in the Post, which was, adopt, you know, kind of, they wrote a book which won the Pulitzer Prize about it called All the President's Men. And then that was later even like adapted into film. And I think like Dustin Hoffman and Robert Redford were involved. And I think it even won an Oscar. But yeah, anyway, so it's really basically a limited hangout. And it's designed to kind of manage public opinion, I think, like for the most part, and public perception as well. And their version kind of has us like kind of believing that it's as simple as Nixon and the Republicans breaking into the DNC in order to, you know, basically just get political dirt on the Democrats leading up to the election, in order to kind of like just help his upcoming reelection campaign and bolster, Nixon's chances, which made absolutely no sense, especially in regard to how he was polling at the time. Like, he was so far ahead of McGovern, which was the only alternative at that time, really. And so it made no sense on its face as far as like the motive, you know,
it also, I don't think it seemed to make sense. Cause I mean, obviously, maybe spoiler alert for those, I mean, like, I guess if you have the public consciousness or even just like really to have no idea, what Nixon resigned. So, yeah. And I mean, my impression, maybe I have a wrong read on it, was kind of like with his favorability and all that too. It's also, it was kind of bizarre that he just kind of was like, I'm resigning, as opposed right. to like fighting it. Like, it probably wouldn't have been a hard fight, assuming right. well, things were on the up and up here.
it was kind of a process, because after the first arraignment of the original burglars, and well, first let me actually like answer your question, yeah. what you initially told me to do. Yeah. So all of this pretty much began with the arrests of five burglars in business suits wearing rubber gloves at around 2:30 in the morning, early morning hours, June 17th, 1972, who committed this break-in at the Democratic National Committee headquarters located in the Watergate office building in D.C. And so these men were in possession of burglary equipment, camera equipment, wiretapping and electronic surveillance devices, tear gas guns, and sequentially numbered $100 bills. And so the DOJ...
sequentially numbered? Wait, what does it even mean?
In order, like...
Like their serial ID number?
Yes, or? Exactly.
So
yeah,
like that, as far as I'm off concerned, the press.
That's how I interpret that. Yeah.
Okay, because mm-hmm. I was like, wait, did someone like postmark each one of like 1, 2, 3 that they can keep track of how many hundreds they have? Or are you saying like the serial number is like sequential, like they came off the same?
That's what I'm saying. Batch. Yeah, I'm okay. pretty sure it's basically just operational money, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, so pretty much I'm under the...
You would think they wouldn't use such fishy money like
you
that.
You would think. Yeah, like, unless there was a secret agenda, Jose.
Yeah, I guess unless you're like trying to get busted, but you're like,
you're getting way ahead of...
Well, not even get busted, but that's like getting busted for something else more than just...
Right.
Although I guess maybe you would want to point to some sort of political shenanigans, so I don't know, maybe that'd be a subtle tell to whatever investigator is like, well, these are numbered, so clearly funny business. Right. I guess my head goes intel... crazy fuckery. I guess you mm-hmm. can see that as left right crazy fuckery too.
Well,
at the time. All right.
Especially when you consider like who was kind of the operational leadership on the ground. Like, mm-hmm. because once we get into that, you'll begin to understand the dynamic, mm-hmm. you know, because I don't think everyone was read in on this secret agenda clearly. But to continue on with kind of the bare bones. As much as I can, it seems like very quickly the DOJ and the FBI connected the funds found on those involved to the committee to reelect the president and the fundraising organization of Richard Nixon's reelection campaign. And so, unbeknownst to the public, not long after the arrests, Alfred Baldwin III, who was the alleged wiretap monitor, began cooperating with the FBI and telling the Bureau that he had been listening to explicitly intimate conversations between men and women but we'll couch that for now. Yeah. It's just very interesting and worth mentioning. But we'll get into Alfred Baldwin III later.
Yeah. All but right. So if there's still more you want to hit on the official narrative, because I did want to back up and kind of talk about the political landscape of the time, but I didn't mean
right.
to cut you off.
No,
I
it'll feed were... into it. This okay, will feed right it. Into it,
yep,
I think.
There you go. For it.
So subsequent investigations and revelations during the trials, that is what prompted the U.S. House of Representatives to grant the House Judiciary Committee expanded investigative authority, which is what led to the Senate Watergate Committee, right? And that's what led to the conducting of the hearings, and which were all televised, right? And so again, it's like it's really just stole the attention of the mass public at this time. Like it really did, especially as it played out over time. And so because you start to see that loyalties become very strained very quickly, you know? And so key witnesses testified that Nixon had sanctioned plans to cover up his administration's involvement in the burglary, and that there was a voice-activated taping system in the Oval Office. Now, Nixon's natural instinct was to basically leverage the CIA to help shut down the investigations. And so he kind of wanted Helms to twist the arm of Hoover and the FBI and really William Sullivan and different. There is kind of, you know, faction within the FBI as well that's sort of internally disputing different goals at this time that were a little bit more in line with the CIA, right? And so, and that we'll get into as well. But so it captivated the public interest. I mean, it really did at this time, you know. And so beyond the televised Senate Watergate hearings, I mean, we have numerous revelations and Nixon's efforts to impede the investigation in 73, which led the House to initiate impeachment proceedings against him. And then the Supreme Court's ruling compelled Nixon to surrender the Oval Office tapes. And that was the smoking gun, right? Because once the Oval Office tapes were surrendered to the Watergate Senate committee, I mean, it was basically over, because you can hear him. First of all, if you listen to the tapes, like, people need to realize, like, a lot of the top officials in the Nixon administration had no fucking idea what was going on. Like, they didn't even know why the break-in was was ordered, right? Which Nixon himself is very confused, it seems, on the tapes. And but he's clearly implicated, and clearly he's involved in trying to run a cover-up operation in regard to this, because that seemed to just be his natural instinct, which I find, you know, it makes sense to me, honestly. But anyway, so at that point, I mean, it really did expose his complicity in the cover-up. So the House Judiciary Committee approved 3 articles of impeachment against Nixon, who subsequently resigned from office on August 9th, 1974, becoming the only U.S. president to ever do so.
Well, his big thing was not wanting to release the tapes. Mm-hmm. And he was trying to, this is where we get a lot of, sometimes we'll hear political discussions about what executive privilege, I believe, or something. And so this has kind of become like a legal thing. Yep. I think in the end, wasn't he able to somehow, I don't know if he was able to hold some back, or I know there were ones that they said, oh, those magically disappeared.
There was a huge scandal over like 18 and a half minutes that were, that were just erased on the tapes. And I'm pretty sure I know who ordered that erasure as well, which is a very interesting connection into all of this. Mm-hmm. And, but so his successor was Gerald Ford. And he pardoned him on September 8th, 1974.
There were shenanigans with getting Ford in place too, wasn't there? Or am I, maybe I'm complaining with something else.
I'm trying to remember, because I know that I can't remember the details, honestly, on the Ford replacement.
I think there was some sort of shenanigans where, and maybe I'm mixing up, maybe I'm thinking of the JFK situation. No, JFK, Lyndon B. Johnson was his VP at the time, and that's so. Yeah. But I think wasn't Gerald Ford either not the VP when this all started and kind of shuffled into place?
It was
something
the,
along those lines.
It was the what was his first name?
Yeah, there was a former VP.
Agnew. Yeah, you remember.
It's almost like they were kind of, it almost seemed convenient that that guy got moved out of place when it looked 100%. Like the king was going to be swapped out. They're like, well, you can't be it, you know?
Right. And he was already compromised by, you know, which we'll get into later. He had been compromised by sexual blackmail, you know, and, but,
cases, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And he ended up having to step down over accepting bribes as the VP, which is pretty crazy. And there's bodies attached to him as far as kind of trying to cover things up. Yeah. And I believe his girlfriend, Spencer Agnew, I think was the name of the original VP, but, that's a crazy story. I might be wrong on his first name. I can't remember now. It's a strange name.
I just find it unique. I just find it unique in this situation. Cause it's like this guy got put into place when at the same time it was almost like a chess piece was being moved into place, you know, dude. Like, so it was kind
that's
of like,
how
okay.
a
I mean,
lot
yeah,
of this,
I mean, sure. You can say it's coincidence and two separate things have the same time. Right. The number one and the number two both got swapped out around, roughly around the same time. But it's like, I don't know. I mean, if you want to connect some dots, it's like, that looks a little weird.
No doubt, so, man. 100%. Yeah. Dude.
Which on the political climate, I would just listen to a thing with Nick Bryan, because I think we mentioned just a little bit ago, he has a book out and he was on Lou Dobbs and he was talking about the political situation. And it sounds to me that, I mean, I'm no historian of Nixon's administration, but it sounds to me like he kind of pulled like a JFK light where he...
easing tensions.
Yeah, well, JFK did that thing where he kind of first came in. And there's a lot of hubbub about, like, you know, rumors about him having links to the mob, and that's kind of what got him in place. But then obviously it's very renowned that once he got in place, he became very adversarial with the mob, with him and his brother. And, you know, the mob is also in a lot of ways borderline synonymous with intelligence. So he kind of created a whole slew of enemies during that time. But essentially the idea that he almost was a Trojan horse, and that the mob thought, oh, this guy's going to go in here and be our guy.
Oh, yeah.
And then he kind of, you know, Order 66'd him. And it sounds like Nixon, from my understanding, was similar in a lot of ways. And that he
had deep
he was
ties
kind of
to the mob, too. Yeah.
Well, they thought he was a company man, and he was going to play the game when it came to certain, like, say like foreign policy stuff, but I believe he was, if I recall correctly, I think he was wanting to kind of like ease relations with Russia and stuff at a time.
That's
where that
exactly
wasn't
what
popular.
Happened. Yeah.
A lot like, I guess you can make comparisons with like Trump and stuff. So he was bucking the establishment's foreign policy line big time. I believe
he was very much upsetting the intelligence community during this time. And like you're saying, one of those major factors was that he signed this National Security Decision Memorandum 2. They called it NSDM 2, and that this is when he began really easing tensions with China and the Soviet Union.
Oh, yeah,
and did
China too, like, I believe. Yeah,
yep,
sorry, go
yep.
on.
And the Soviet Union, and did because it was Nixon, right, that opened the door to China and allowed relations with Mao at that time, right, under the Kissinger kind of doctrine, sort of. But it's weird because I find this very interesting, because it almost feels like he was at odds with at least Kissinger's mentor. So it's very interesting how this played out. But so he basically started easing tensions with China, doing weapons deals even with the Soviet Union, and he was using Vietnam all the while as like a bargaining chip throughout this time. And meanwhile, he's bombing the shit out of Vietnam too. So it's like, you know, it's not like,
yeah, I'm not saying this guy's perfect. I mean, I would even say
he was bleeding us out in
Many people rightfully, you know, point out with JFK a lot of his flaws and a lot of bad foreign policy decisions and this and that. Definitely. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying any of these guys are my ideal cap president, but I'm saying so far as same thing with Trump. Clearly there was an attempt at a coup. And you, I guess you can make a case whether it was, you know, whether it was successful or not while he was in office. And, that's, I mean, that you can definitely say, and I by no means say he's a perfect either, but like, it's, I mean, you're kind of bringing up like the Kissinger thing and like the kind of the idea that like, yeah, you can have establishment characters that have two different plans in mind, and that, and neither of those are necessarily the correct plan. But they can still go at odds and they can clash things like major events that, you know, shift landscapes can happen as a result.
Definitely.
So, yeah, I think that's So that's no, by no means saying that whatever, I don't know, I'm sure if somebody could be like, well, his foreign policy here, this foreign policy there, but it's like, well, he was clearly trying to make political moves that certain other political people didn't like. That's all the only point I'm trying to make. I'm not trying to say he was on the straight and narrow on what fucking decisions he should be making, because no, I mean, there's not really any politician that did that, so.
That was that NSDM2, by the way, that National Security Decision Memorandum, that is also, I got it wrong when I was initially saying it was the National Defense Authorization Act or something. So it was actually this NSDM is where Nixon had the clause in it where it kept Helms from, he was like barely able to even be in the national security briefing, and then he would have to leave. It was like they were at war. They were at odds with each other, Nixon and Helms, Richard Helms, who was running the CIA during this time. And it's pretty extraordinary to the level it really gets. I mean, even on the tapes, man, like it gets crazy. And so clearly he's largely defying the political will of the intelligence community, you know, at this time. I mean, it seems that way. It really does. And he's almost, I feel like he thinks that he has the leverage in a lot of these situations, man. I mean, he's flexing his muscle. He really is. Like, it's pretty crazy what he says to Helms on some of the tapes. Yeah. And I mean, so
real quick, this, not to jump the shark, but do you think Nixon was a predator, or do you think he just had information on people? Because I guess this kind of goes to our conversation, and obviously we're jumping way ahead. This kind of goes to our conversation we're just having, where it's like he clearly was bucking establishment lines, but I'm trying to make the point that doesn't mean he's a good guy. He just may be on different wavelengths between some other bad guys.
Definitely.
And as a result, they've come to a crossroads. So
I have yet to find a reason to doubt what Fiona Barnett claims about what Nixon did to her. So I do kind of lean toward, I certainly think it's possible.
I just know I've heard in a lot of stories too, when it comes to those sort of things, a lot of times, whether there's truth to it or not, because it makes sense that there'd be truth to it. This is where a lot of times talk about, like, people talk about like white hats and black hats within like intelligence. So the white hats are the ones who see these sort of things, are disgusted and long for a better, more idealized version of their fucking, you know, intel agency or whatever the fuck, you know? And to be fair, okay, sure, maybe there are some people who bought the Kool-Aid and they see these awful things and they go, holy fuck. And like, yeah, that makes sense that there would be people that would have those tendencies. And maybe even some of them may have, dipped their pen in a little bit of sin as well. But I mean, this is the Intel game where it's like, and now they get to have this circular logic where they're like, oh, well, this is so I can get in good and bust these guys. But like, you're just kind of doing sort of the same thing they're doing. So I don't know. It's a mind fuck, but I don't know. It just made me think of that, just kind of that concept that, I mean, even if he wasn't engaged in it, he was kind of like, he was literally holding onto this information literally just for political leverage. So like, even if you want to make the case he's a white hat and he's playing some crazy long game, it's like, I don't know. It seems more transactional and more like a utilitarian. Like, I know these people's tendencies and I'm going to use it against them. So and that, you know, whether you want to say he's involved in those things himself or not, it's a different story. I don't know. So, but yeah, anyways, to the point that I'm not necessarily saying he's a good guy.
Right. I know, man. And I had mentioned Kissinger's mentor, who plays I think he's a huge factor in this as well. And his name was Fritz Kramer. All right. And this guy, he even told Nixon that, like, he basically was speaking to him like he was a child. And he went to him and said, you can't pull out of Vietnam. You know, like, he literally told him that he would look weak, you know, to the public. And so, and he, Fritz Kramer is, man, he's absolutely an extraordinary story, this guy, because it seems like, I mean, first of all, he's the one who in like the 1940s allegedly discovered Henry Kissinger in the first place. And then, he was like, he had recruited Kissinger into the army division, all right, and Kramer persuaded Kissinger to attend Harvard University. He shaped Kissinger's reading and thinking. This is a quote from Kissinger. Kramer shaped my reading and thinking influenced my choice of college, awakened my interest in political philosophy and history, inspired both my undergraduate and graduate thesis, and became an integral and indispensable part of my life. That's Henry Kissinger. And other people, even Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, they all worship this guy. I mean, they have, there's an insane quote by Donald Rumsfeld where he says, like, he holds the black flame. And it made me think of the Setian doctrine of Michael Aquino, because that's what they literally call it, the black flame. I was like, what the fuck, man? Like, I don't know. It, maybe there's something additional to pull on there is all I'm saying.
Yeah, that's a, that might be that kind of information that's behind the veil that you don't really,
100%.
You can surmise, but we probably may never know for sure.
Exactly.
So, you know, like what kind of weird, dark going on.
No doubt. And one of the key players in all of this and how it inevitably played out is Alexander Haig, right? And he was, after the huge scandal, he's named as Nixon's White House chief of staff. And he basically ran the country for like 15 months, right? Like, it's kind of insane. The story, I think somebody's writing a book about that. Like the 15-month president is what it's called, I think, actually, if I can recall. And so, yeah, not only did this guy discover a young Henry Kissinger, he discovers Alexander Haig. And
the
so
lizard people's emissary. Is
what that's what it looks like, man. It was tripping me out reading all, you know, through this, but, but,
that's the dude, the inner earth grays send is their mouth of Sauron.
Exactly.
Us, us fucking peasants.
100% dude. So he recommends Haig as the military assistant to then National Security Advisor Kissinger. Right. And so, and by the way, Kramer's son also served in the Nixon-Kissinger National Security Council. But from the early 1950s until 78, when Kramer retired from civil service, he served as senior civilian advisor to the U.S. Army Chief of Staff in the Pentagon and influenced the Department of Defense during the Cold War. And during his time at the Pentagon, he also influenced Secretaries of Defense, James Schlesinger, and Donald Rumsfeld. He served on the White House National Security Staff under 10 presidents. I was just like, yeah, that's okay. You know, what is it? Unelected bureaucrats, you know?
He's got the butt fucking pictures of all the presidents. So.
And by the way, you mentioned that so many of these players are gay, and I don't get it, but it seems like it's a huge blackmail tool at this time, you know? So,
well, yeah, I mean, it is. We talked to Nick when we had him on our show, just kind of like the kind of people, and I'm not even necessarily saying, you know, homosexuality means you're bad, but it's also like, it's the idea of things that were at certain points in time, you know, frowned upon behavior. And then also, you know, straight up degeneracy as well, but like just kind of the kind of people that you're going to get that are involved in these are going to be people that have dirt on them as well, or that can fit into these, you know, realms of society they need to infiltrate. So, I mean, like, you know, obviously now the homosexuality angle has almost no power to it. I'm sure if someone was able to get dirt on like Mike Pence doing gay stuff, then like, yeah, okay, that makes sense. It completely ruins the
sense. Yeah.
But you know, any new up and comings, it's losing its power. But you know, 10, 20 years ago, you know, if you were a Fruit Loop CIA agent and you know, got with some, you know, big highfalutin, you know, person of interest or whatever, some politician, that's legitimate leverage. Like that can be used to your benefit. So it's kind of like the kind of people, the kind of players that you're going to get involved are going to be ones that usually hang out in the, and even then on top of that, they're also the ones that are willing to weaponize that. So like, and you know, to the point where I'm like, I'm not even saying homosexuality is a bad thing. I know I make a lot of jokes at Tower Gang and stuff, but it's like, these are also the homosexuals that have no problem using that as a cudgel against people.
Exactly.
Like, you know, if that, the thing that's also a probably, that's obviously likely true about them, unless they just aren't even gay and are just willing to do that just to for the mission. I guess they could make, although I think that's pretty gay, but
definitely do.
You can lie to yourself and tell yourself that, I guess. I don't know.
Right.
Who's that good of a CIA agent? But yeah, I don't know. There's something gross about that. Like, these are not only the people that hang out in the dregs of society, they're the ones perfectly content with being the dregs of society and persecuting the dregs of society.
Yeah. That, definitely. Know? Yeah.
So it's like, what kind of person are you?
Exactly.
Like, it's the idea that, like, if I was, like, you know, if I had a coke addiction and I hung out with unsavory people, I'd be like, I'm engaging in this behavior, and I would feel wrong about ratting out those people.
Right.
But to, like, literally sign up to be like, I want to beat the rat, you're like, dude, you're a piece of shit. Especially for when real, you're like, man, these are behaviors I like to engage in. So you're like, okay, all right. Yeah. So
man. No, you're good. To finish, just a couple more notes on this Kramer. Man, Fitz Kramer is just an insane story, man, because he's also considered to be the real Dr. Strangelove, which I've heard about a few people. So it's kind of a composite character that Kubrick made about a lot of these Rand Corporation guys and a lot of the Brookings Institute guys too, who but he was specifically described as the father of the neoconservative movement in U.S. foreign policy, and was he had this theory called the provocative weakness theory. And he basically says that, you know, if you come to negotiate, if you come to the table to negotiate, you just, like, he basically says, don't negotiate, come with a loaded gun and point it at their head. That's what he says, right? Like, this is who Fritz Kramer is, right?
The ultimate Chad.
Definitely, man. It's so crazy to me.
I will not debate.
Right? So insane, but
yeah.
So he graduated the National War College, right? Advised, taught, and inspired generations of officers, officials, American presidents. And so, yeah, like I said, described as Dr. Strangelove and Kissinger's Kissinger. That was one of my favorites that I saw. And he was apparently
a little Kissinger's Kissinger. He's already like a deformed little like chicken nugget, right, of a human being. Imagine he had his own little chicken nugget of a human being. Sorry, stupid thought. Go on.
So he was apparently like flamboyant and eccentric as well. And he wore a monocle, and it like became his trademark.
That's pretty dope, actually.
Oh my God, dude. But anyway, so he,
this is like the 80s.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah.
Rocking a monocle in the 80s. That is a solid fashion choice.
Apparently he was invited, like, when they were launching the war in Iraq in 01, he was invited to the
Pentagon. What's the fashion style? We talking like Elton John? Because you say he's flamboyant. Like, what are we talking about?
Dude, I don't know. I mean,
all right, now I want to look at pictures of this guy.
I know. I need to look at him, honestly, because I've only read about him.
Like,
how
you pulled off a monocle running through, like, Intel, like, and running around this world.
Right. That is hilarious.
Yeah. But I don't know. I can imagine it, an 80s style monocle. Right? But all right, go ahead.
Well, he founded like just a think tank that, you know, fits the bill, you know, clearly. It's called the World Security Network Foundation. And it was a think tank specifically for global affairs and had like 22 generals and admirals involved in the think tank. And it became one of the largest think tanks in all of global affairs, basically. But that, I felt like we should at least establish who that was, because according to Lynn Kolodny, I mean, he was a huge, influence, right? And he wrote a book called, besides writing Silent Coup, he wrote this book called 40 Years War. And it really kind of details the, kind of this war that Nixon had with Helms and what led to a lot of this. And and he really does think that Fritz Kramer played a huge role in one Kissinger and Alexander Haig's, like, just just his influence on them throughout this time. And so that's an interesting read. I haven't gotten all the way through it, but what I've read of it, it's like brilliant, man. And it's like, it's really blowing my mind. So he's a super valuable source for all this. But anyway, beyond that, I mean, it's all of like, when you get into who the original Watergate 7 were and like what exactly happened there, because there, it really kind of refers to 14 different people, like two groups of seven, because it was like it was the burglars themselves with the two handlers, right? Because there were five people. Yeah. But so we should at least cover, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, spoiler alert, I think like what, over like almost half of them are confirmed feds.
Yeah, well, all the five. Right. Yeah, and I mean, honestly, man, like all the, the seven who were involved in the break-in, other than G. Gordon Liddy, he's the only one who's not directly CIA Bay of Pigs guys, right? So that alone is outrageous. And I'll introduce the key players really quickly, because I find it interesting what happens as far as when G. Gordon Liddy like introduced Howard Hunt and James McCord, who we're about to talk about. They act as if they don't know each other, but they have a past, right? They know each other very well, you know, and I find that alone, you know, very interesting and a crucial detail. But yeah, so by the way, after Nixon was pardoned by Gerald Ford, right, the Watergate scandal ultimately resulted in like 69 indictments, and I think it was like 48 convictions is what the end result was. And I mean, it was, several of them were high-ranking officials from Nixon's administration, right? And like I said, man, like there were quite a few who were entirely unaware of what exactly this plot was and even the reason behind the break-in. And it seems like White House aide John Dean, who we'll get into as well, he's a very big key player in this. It really seems like he was being very dishonest with Nixon after the break-in. And so he kind of he starts to become like the main factor in helping Nixon in the cover-up, and then he immediately flips key witness. And it's nuts. But I think he might have been compromised, so we're going to have to touch on that. But so anyway, the infamous Watergate 7, like I said, refers to two different groups involved in this scandal. And the original five caught in the burglary, along with their two handlers, who are E. Howard Hunt and G. Gordon Liddy. I really believe that Hunt and McCord were more in charge of what was happening on the ground than Gordon Liddy was ever aware of, you know. And I think that maybe Gordon Liddy wasn't even aware of the secondary agenda that was playing out as well. So anyway, they were all tried before Judge John Sirica in like early 1973. And so then the second group it applies to are these seven advisors and White House aides to the president who were subsequently indicted by a grand jury. I think it was early March in 74. And so Nixon himself, that's when he was named as an unindicted co-conspirator. And that was unprecedented, right? Like never happened in the history. And so original Watergate 7 and their legal dispositions are: one, G. Gordon Liddy, former FBI agent, general counsel for the Committee to Reelect the President, CRP, CREEP, convicted of burglary, conspiracy, and wiretapping, and sentenced to 6 years and 8 months in prison, served 4.5 years in prison. He had the longest sentence, right? Then you have E. Howard Hunt, who was a CIA operative, deeply involved in Operation 40 and the Kennedy assassination, and also, I mean, many other things. I mean, my God, the guy was involved in the Che assassination and execution, and like also he was involved in, oh, here it is, coup, like, yeah, the coup in Iran, right? The coup in Guatemala, overthrowing our bins, and Allende in Chile, right?
Dude,
which
dude got around. You know,
yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Dude. Yeah. I mean, and by the way, he was involved with, and I think I've mentioned this to you once, but he's involved in this highly secretive office in the CIA called the Office of Security. And mm-hmm. it was the only section in the entire agency that reported directly to Helms, right?
Yeah, that was what a lot of people kind of refer to as kind of like the off-book CIA, essentially. That was kind of like they were creating two CIAs at the time. That's kind of why this slice of history that we're dissecting is kind of interesting. I think there were a lot of weird stuff going on with the CIA at that time. Obviously, there's always a lot of weird stuff going on, but I think they were at some sort of odd crossroads between all the JFK stuff, the Nixon stuff. They were kind of playing fast and loose with trying to orchestrate things on their behalf around mm-hmm. that period of time, like big time, like domestically, like you know, yes. like and not just like you know toppling, you know, countries, you know, elsewhere. They're like yeah. literally like fucking with. You know, the arrangement of the you know, key players in our state, you know, like mm-hmm. that type yep. of stuff. So
yeah, and this was right around the exact same time that Operation Chaos was greenlit. So everybody mm-hmm. needs to keep that in mind, right? Because that is clearly the CIA's version of the FBI's COINTELPRO, which is domestic operations. I mean, that's what it is, you know, mm-hmm. You read what Chaos was. It's PatCon. You know, it's the same as when you read what COINTELPRO was.
They just do more like cutout type things to get further away from it. So that's why you have this splinter cell of the CIA with the Office of Security or whatever. And then from there, then they have their own separate cutout. So it's like so compartmentalized that it's... And you get to a point where you're like, yeah, well, technically CIA is not supposed to act domestically. But this guy's in he's like in this super secret spot that we're like isolating this information. And even now he's working within this private entity that, you know, but then he just.
Mullen and company Howard Hunt.
Proven
CIA front company. Yeah. But his third retirement from the agency. So everybody just rest
assured.
Yeah, and
this is where the office security, if I recall correctly, I believe is kind of tied into a lot of like the Wacken Hut and that type of. Like they were almost setting up the infrastructure for a separate mm-hmm. CIA. And it almost was like the Office of Security was kind of like the hub to where they were kind of creating their private network of their private CIA, which is obviously publicly funded, you know, but it's just mm-hmm. they're doing the same exact, you know, activities, but through their, you know, private entities that they or their friends own or operate.
Right. Man, it blows my mind. Mm-hmm. And so Howard Hunt, he did. And by the way, he's. Like I said, CIA operative, leader of the White House plumbers, convicted of burglary, conspiracy, and wiretapping as well. And he was sentenced to 2.5 years to 8 years in prison, but only served 33 months, right? And so then you have Bernard Barker, member of the plumbers, FBI agent, alleged CIA undercover operative, which he was. He was a member of Bay of Pigs as well. And E. Howard Hunt went under... codenamed Eduardo and during Op 40 Bay of Pigs, and the Cubans looked at him as a legend, and we'll get into that, because Eugenio Martinez, I think he's one of the most interesting, like, yeah, he doesn't say everything, but he really sheds such a valuable perspective and window into what happened on the ground in the burglaries. And how suspicious even he was, right? As to how it went down, how it occurred, operational procedures on the ground level. He was just like blown away. And I love his perspective at the very least, even if he is the one with the key to Ida Maxie Wells' desk that we'll talk about later as well, which he tried to swallow when Carl Schauffler was like beating his ass. But anyway, that story gets crazy. But Bernard Barker, all right, like I said, member of the plumbers, CIA undercover operative, He pled guilty.
The plumbers. Yeah. What even is that? Because like as I said, I've done not because I hear that and I'm like, is that literally just like an organization that is like calls themselves like they're the ones who do the plumbing in the White House or some shit? Like
it was. Like, so I specifically detail it here in a moment, but it is just it's just a group under the Committee to Reelect the President that was basically it was created just after the Ellsberg leaks. And so when that was published, right, the Ellsberg papers, the Pentagon papers was soon as it was published, within a week, less than a week, the White House plumbers were created, and they were called the plumbers, and they made it a joke. It was supposed to be covert as hell. And it turns out that Hunt and Liddy and McCord made a plaque that said, "We're the plumbers," and put it in the fucking White House.
The joke being like, we're plumbers, like, we're, you know,
plugging leaks.
Oh, we're plumbing. Oh, we're
and also like we're plugging
espionage
leaks.
Type.
Yeah. Which was the main thing. And I believe it, I can't remember who it was, one of the operatives' mothers who said this as a joke when the guy went home. I read about it. I can't remember who it was, but that's how they adopted this nickname. It's so ridiculous, but.
Because I think a lot of people actually hear about the plumbers and they literally think that there were actual plumbers. As plumbers. No, I do think people. So I think there is this like subtle thing that people then tie that into like in their head, like espionage, like some guy pretending to be a maintenance worker.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. I think there's some association there because I think of like plumbers and my mind does like word association with like Intel. So, and I think like, this guy just happened to be the guy doing your fucking satellite work that day. You know what I mean? Like, or whatever the thing is, you know,
right.
Everyone's like all schizophrenic, like, oh, that's fucking Intel. Like, I get that idea from it. But okay. Definitely. So they legit were just some made up fucking company or
no, like, they were just an organization that was made within the internalized intelligence operation that was greenlit in the White House. Again, I detail exactly the reason here in just a moment, because it's specifically has to do with this internal struggle, this war against the CIA, and the FBI is not helping Nixon at this time either. They're kind of, you know, dragging their feet in many ways. They don't want to actually help him with his domestic spying, you know, that he really wants to crack down on dissidents. He's like, he's pushing hard for domestic spying. And they were okay with that, but they wanted in full reign of, in full control of it. They didn't want to be doing it as Nixon's bitch, basically, is kind of what the scenario was, right? Mm-hmm. And especially when they were at odds at this time. And so Nixon felt like he didn't have an intelligence agency he could rely on. And so he created one himself under this private intelligence operation within the White House. And
the plumbers, that's what you're, or is that
no,
what
it
you're
falls
saying?
Within the committee to reelect the president is what it really falls under. Mm-hmm. And the plumbers are a part of that. Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So
I mean, obviously they were undermining him, but they were,
certain members were right. Yes. And again, it's very compartmentalized even within this group, you know,
Intel games. Yeah. You can tell when I listened to your coverage of it and you can tell there are people getting different information. Some people maybe more in the know than others, and it is like, you know, people it's like an op within an op within an op, like,
dude,
it really is these spy games. It really is these spy games. You're like, oh my god, like, yeah, they're like setting up this one guy within it that's like, oh yeah, he's the fall. We know you're gonna take the fall or whatever. You know, or you can tell they're getting limited information. But yeah, exactly. Either way, yeah, bizarre. But I'll let you go.
Very much so. You're good. Barker was inevitably sentenced to 18 months to 6 years, and that was for the first charge. Reversed his plea and served 18 months in prison, and later sentenced to 2.5 to 6 years in prison for the second charge, and served one additional year in prison. And so that was Bernard Barker, one of the member of the plumbers and one of the burglars at the Watergate. And he was CIA undercover operative involved in Bay of Pigs. He also was one of the main guys who, even when Eugenio Martinez later starts to distrust Howard Hunt, Bernard Barker is blind to it. Like, in the way Eugenio explains it, he basically says that Bernard just almost worshipped him as a legend and couldn't even see it as a possibility that Howard would potentially, you know, kind of, you know, be disloyal to them and throw them under in this way. And so Virgilio Gonzalez was a Cuban refugee, one of the Bay of Pigs guys, and a locksmith. All right. He was convicted of conspiracy, burglary, and wiretapping like all the rest, and sentenced to 1 to 4 years in prison, serving 13 months. Eugenio Martinez was also Cuban exile, CIA undercover operative. And he was sentenced to 1 to 4 years, serving 15 months, pardoned by Ronald Reagan, which I thought was interesting. And so then James McCord, former CIA officer, FBI agent, convicted on 8 counts of conspiracy, burglary, and wiretapping, sentenced to 25 years in prison, reduced to 1 to 5 years in prison after he implicated others in the plot, served only 4 months. So he was one of the key witnesses who flipped with John Dean. Yeah. So beyond being a former CIA, just like Howard Hunt, he just happened to retire from the CIA very recently. He was also a member of the Office of Security, the highly secretive group within, you know, directly reporting to Helm. So it's just like, man, come on now. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
And so Frank Sturgis, he was a legitimate CIA hitman, you know, and I mean, you can say that about Hunt too. He killed people as well. I mean, but so Sturgis, he was really heavily involved in wet works though. And he was a guerrilla trainer as well. And like, you know, he inevitably was separately charged of transporting stolen cars to Mexico and sentenced to 1 to 4 years in prison. But the sentence for the transport charge was folded into the Watergate sentence. And I guess due to his cooperation. And so he served only 14 months. Right, for both charges. And so then to quickly establish the 7 advisors that are also considered in under this Watergate 7 was John Mitchell, former United States Attorney General, director of Nixon's 68 to 72 election campaigns, and faced a maximum of 30 years in prison and $42,000 in fines. And on February 1975, Mitchell was found guilty of conspiracy, obstruction of justice, and perjury, and sentenced to 2.5 to 8 years in prison, which was reduced to 1 to 4 years. And he actually served like 19 months. Then we have H.R. Haldeman, White House Chief of Staff, considered the second most powerful man in the government during Nixon's first term. Faced a maximum of 25 years in prison and $16,000 in fines in 1975. He would be convicted of conspiracy, obstruction, receiving 18-month sentence. And when when Haldeman stepped down, because Nixon was kind of forced to fire a lot of his staff after this all went public, Haldeman basically claims he made a serious mistake, and he told Nixon, and he suggested to Nixon that he should replace him, Haldeman, as White House Chief of Staff, with Alexander Haig. And yeah, that doesn't work out very well for Nixon, right? And so Haldeman, I think, was a real supporter and loyal to Nixon. I think they were actual friends, and he had kind of his best interests at heart. But clearly, all being deceived in many ways, like especially the individuals who were unaware of the secret agenda, which included Nixon himself, clearly. And so John Ehrlichman was the third of the seven of the aides, right? The advisors. And so Ehrlichman was former assistant to Nixon in charge of domestic affairs. And so he was, and he was inevitably, I think he served like 18 months as well. And then Charles Colson, he brought in Howard Hunt and was actually, he actually was a classmate with Howard Hunt at Brown University and knew him personally. And so he was a former White House counsel and specializing in political affairs. And so he ended up being sentenced to 1 to 3 years and fined $5,000, serving like 7 months. So then it's like three additional aides, Gordon C. Strachan, Robert Mardian, and Kenneth Parkinson. And they were all involved with the committee to reelect the president, right? And was a lawyer, and Parkinson was, and so, and was kind of like G. Gordon Liddy's counsel, you know? And so those were basically what's referred to as the Watergate Seven, which is really 14 people inside Nixon's administration at this time, which are heavily implicated in the committee to reelect the president and this private intelligence operation within the White House that we keep referencing. And so more, it's like, it really begins to make a lot more sense whenever you start to understand the landscape, because you have to keep in mind like the dishonest framework of the Watergate affair, right? Like, I mean, it's basically the time the government got it right in a way, right? Like by exposing and rooting out internal corruption in the form of Nixon's symbolic downfall. And it's just a fairy tale, man. Like it really is, you know, and I can't believe that. Well, I can't.
Yeah, this held up as no one's above the law. Like, exactly. It's like, oh, well, you guys completely swapped the frame on that. And it was a complete distortion, like sort of, 100%. But I know that's not the takeaway you really should get from that. So
no. But, yeah. So Nixon had gone to both the CIA, right, and the FBI requesting assistance in running surveillance operations against various political dissidents and prominent individuals who were in opposition of his administration. And so basically the story goes that he allegedly received pushback from both Helms and Hoover, who were seemingly unwilling to aid Nixon in his domestic surveillance operations without certain conditions being met, which they were just demanding flat out to even help him in general, like when it came to this. And I found that like, just, it doesn't, I mean, of course it makes sense, because I mean, Hoover, I mean, damn, that guy was in there for how long, right? Like it's absolutely crazy to me. And especially with how this played out, because he died during all of this, Hoover, and William Sullivan was kind of like his number two, besides Mark Felt was really the number two. But Mark Felt was like almost in agreement with Hoover in regard to giving the CIA all this cover, and, you know, and so Felt got passed over when it came to, he was supposed to be the replacement for Hoover. And that just wasn't in the cards at this time, right? And I think that they were pretty much overruled and the CIA took the day in a way. But it played a major factor, right? Like, and especially in Nixon's decision to set up this private intelligence operation out of the White House, and it, I mean, just in general to form the committee to reelect the president, you know? Mm-hmm. And that began around late 1970, right? When that's exactly around the time you can trace this. And I mean, this committee to reelect the president was almost overtly, but I mean, clearly covertly, but was engaging in money laundering and slush funds, and like used it. the CRP used $500,000 in the legal expenses for the five Watergate burglars. So, you know, it's like they're directly connected to every aspect of this, right? And here's a huge reason why the public just entirely believed that Nixon was to blame for this. And he was clearly behind the break-in. And because it was fed as, right, just getting dirt on political rivals, like we said earlier. And so the White House plumber unit, it also began as a part of this operation just at this same time, and just so happened to be established in June of 71. And like I said earlier, within a week of the publication of the Pentagon Papers, which is, there's not a coincidence there, especially when the first break-in is Dr. Fielding's office. And that is literally the psychiatrist for Daniel Ellsberg. Right. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's just ridiculous. Right.
Yeah.
So, a few of the key members of the plumbers unit, right, were the CIA hitman Frank Sturgis, ex-FBI agent G. Gordon Liddy, who, by the way, he's apparently famous for the arrest of Timothy Leary, which I was like, that's a little strange, you know?
Wait, the actor, but, or am I thinking of somebody else?
No, Timothy Leary, what is it?
Who am I thinking of?
Tune in... something and drop out. I can't remember what it is, but he's the MK Ultra all day long, like connected to counterculture. Yeah. And he was one of those that were a key in kind of the LSD experience of that age. Right. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Timothy Leary, I think he's,
I think it's Dennis Leary. Maybe that's who it is. Maybe there's an actor named Dennis Leary.
Oh shit. What is that dude's name? Yeah. Anyway, doesn't matter. Anyways, but I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, I was like, what dot are you trying to connect me here with that guy getting arrested?
Well, okay. The Timothy Leary thing is that he's so deeply involved in like the Laurel Canyon scene, the MK Ultra scene in San Francisco at the time, Haight Ashbury and the process, and like he's deeply tied in with the mamas and the papas too. And oh my God, by the way, Alexander Butterfield. Who he later comes up as one of the, I guess he was really the guy that was tapped on the shoulder, in my opinion, based on the direction of Alexander Haig, who, according to Lynn Kolodny, was using Bob Woodward as the cat's paw at this time. He was using Woodward to suggest to the Watergate Senate Select Committee to interview and interrogate. Dude, it gets so freaking crazy because it's Butterfield who's the only guy who can actually make public the existence of the White House taping system. It's just like, oh my God, that's no coincidence either, man. You know, like in no way, in my opinion, right? And again, it'll make more sense as we go, but it's just extraordinary story, man. Like it's very complicated because there's so many moving parts, but it's really not as hard to understand once you start to realize just what exactly was playing out as far as the power dynamic, you know. I really think it's one of the most important aspects of all of this because I don't think it would have happened otherwise, right? Like I think, well, I don't want to get off the fence yet, but anyway.
Well, we're kind of set the landscape. Are we at a point? I think next episode we want to kind of get into the robbery itself and how that got into it. Do you think we're at a good point to pull the cord now? Or, I mean, you let me know if you want to craft more of the one landscape.
One little part about, because I at least want to get us up into the point of Operation Gemstone, which... I was launched by really kind of the brainchild of Liddy, they claim. But, you know, John Mitchell, all these guys, they were a part of it, right? They were clearly a part of it. And it's a huge reason as to how there were so much. I mean, it was basically millions of dollars that they were suggesting should be, you know, siphoned into this operation. I mean, it's absolutely crazy. The kind of the depth and breadth of what they were attempting to accomplish with this. And Jim Stone outlines what happened at Watergate, because it's literally a part of the operation was burglaries, was one of the big aspects, and burglaries at, like, diplomatic, right, like facilities like the Watergate, right, which makes sense. But so quickly, just to finish this out, is that basically it was, like I said, members of the White House plumbers were Frank Sturgis, Gordon Liddy, and then Nixon administration official Eagle Crow, who allegedly recommended Liddy, and Nixon's hatchet man Charles Colson, who was the one who apparently recommended Howard Hunt and was also was a classmate of his at Brown University, like I said. And so Hunt was now posing as the retired CIA, you know, working for the Mullen and Company, which was like a PR agency. And it's since been outed as a CIA front operation. And it's just, man, there's no coincidence. And James McCord, also a CIA officer who is part of the OS, and he is now appointed as head of security for CREEP, Committee to Reelect the President. And this is when the Moore Radford affair really becomes crucial to understand, because basically the Joint Chiefs of Staff had launched a spying operation against Nixon, right? It's like, it's really crazy, but it's what I think kind of brings us to the reason why Nixon was launching this private intelligence operation in the first place, was because he had exposed a spy ring that was being wielded against him.
Part of the component of what I was getting at with these splinters, like this almost like other CIA existing. There, this war of the CIAs that were kind of happening at this point in time. Although that's not the best way to put it. But it's right. Like you had the rogue CIA kind of doing whatever the fuck it wanted, and mm-hmm. you had other entities trying to kind of, you know, clash. And I do think there probably were, you know, in some of these things going on at the time, there were legit actual intel agent, wars within the own intel agencies. Oh, yeah. So I think definitely that was a component of this breakup that, you know, I think understanding the infrastructure of this really does inform things later. So you just kind of realize how they operate, how they touch things. You can kind of wave away the illusion of having being in any way reined in by the state.
Right.
So, and it makes you sound a lot less crazy when you start thinking about how they go about doing things, and you can start plugging and playing their methodology and be like, oh, well, that makes sense now. Whereas when you don't have this sort of understanding, you just sound like schizophrenic.
Definitely. So, yeah. But I mean, when there's such excruciating details that we can point to where it's like you can lay out the foundation of this theory and it seems so much more plausible than the official narrative. It's just, to me, it's like, I think the only thing that we can debate is like the claims later on in this, which, you know, go as deep as potential pedophilia and things of that nature, which, you know, I know the call girl operation is legitimate. And so it's just like, it feels like one of the most complex scandals in American history in a way, because of how much, like you were saying earlier, the layers that you can continue to pry and pull. It's just, you realize that it's the perfect example, right? As far as our common enemy is concerned, you know, and clearly there's no hero in this, in my opinion, right? Yep. Other than
kind of was so, driving it with a Nixon point earlier, because I feel like when I lay out why the intelligence agency might want him gone, right. It makes some people, like especially in our our spheres go, oh, well, does that mean you're saying you like him? Because he's, you know, I'm not,
right.
Just because he's an enemy of my enemy, it doesn't necessarily mean he's my friend. Like,
exactly.
They can just be two enemies that are fighting each other. Mm-hmm. And, you know, yeah. I mean, I might have an opinion on who should win, but I don't know. I'm not really having any sort of any part in this game.
So, yep.
Yeah, I don't know. Any last thoughts, I guess, you know, kind of wrapping up?
Honestly, I think we have so much left that it's just probably the best place we could stop, you know, because it really, I think that we can start out at least in part two, we can kind of tie this off and then get into the real details of the burglaries, because I think that once you realize, you know, exactly the course of the operational procedure took, it starts to become very clear and obvious, like, what was the potential goal here, you know? And so anyway, yeah, it's one of the most extraordinary stories I've ever come across, honestly, man. And I'm excited to get to the bottom of it.
You're like, it's nuts when you start seeing like the real story and you're like, this was really like the wool was pulled over all our eyes like this. It's nuts. But anyways, Austin, if you have any final thoughts, feel free, but just let people know where they can find you at. What are there any upcoming things you got, things like that. Maybe your social media, if you ever start wanting to use that, you know.
How dare you? My God.
Yeah, I'm bad. It's funny. I get shit from like all my other buddies, like Tower Game Buddies, have like bigger accounts. But like, I just go through periods of time where I'm just not that inspired. Every now and then I'll have like a funny joke in my head or a deep thought and I'll share it. But for the most part, I just like maybe once a week pop in and be like, check out this week's No Way Jose. That's about all I really do on there.
I honestly think what it is that I'm so freaking tired by the time I'm done. Like, just I have to read so much to kind of put a lot of this together that it's like I just have so much of my time is consumed with either isolating clips but I need to find a way to post more often with it, because I mean, clearly it's all very interesting.
If you're pulling clips for your show, you should start using a lot of those for tweets.
I really should.
Those are the kind of things that fucking go on, and then you can put like a little reply and put your thing. Right. Anyways, social media tips for another time.
right. But what I was gonna say is just one final thought is just how often throughout researching and studying this scandal, Watergate. Like I was just like slapped in the face with other glaring examples that we've pointed to over time with all the content that we've covered. Like, I mean, when we get into the arrest of the burglars in the Watergate and you find out Carl Schauffler's role, one of the arresting officers, you're just going to feel like, oh yeah, the guy that was waiting to arrest Tim McVeigh. Like that's what it feels like, you know? And there's so much of that, right? So anyway, it's kind of, if it wasn't, you know, if aspects of it weren't so dark, then, you know, it's kind of an exciting story. But anyway, other than that, support me on Buzzsprout and Patreon. Like I said, I'm going to really try and attempt to set up my Patreon by next week. I have that done and finally be like posting to it a little bit. But beyond that, you can follow me on Twitter at Underclass Pod, on Instagram at The Underclass Podcast, and find my podcast on basically all audio streaming platforms, The Underclass Podcast.
Mm-hmm. Well, all right, guys, I do want to let you know that today's episode was brought to you by Nadeau Shave Co. Big Shave has been psyoping the American people for decades with their multi-blade razor scam. Don't fall for that bullshit. Get rid of that razor burn, the irritation, those ingrown hairs that are caused by that multi-blade nonsense. Return to traditional shave. Do it just like your grandpa used to do. It's cheaper. It's better for your skin. It's just altogether just better. Look at the picture. The thing is pretty slick. I mean, you go, what is it? It's $75 allows you to shave for the entire year, and that's just a ballpark. You get one traditional safety razor there, and you get a box of 100 stainless steel razor blades as well. Those will last you as long as you can make them last, But obviously, you know, he's saying a year, so that's the ballpark. But I'm telling you, you can go longer. But keep an eye out. There's going to be some new shave, body, and hair soaps available soon. NadeauShaveCo.com. Use Jose for 10% off your entire order. All right, guys, like, share, subscribe, comment, all that good stuff. Share around this show. That's how it gets around. We always say the words that de-boost us on YouTube. We say the no-no words. So help us out with that. Follow me on Twitter at TowerGangJose. And with that, we are out.